You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Times Like Now is an interview program. Interviews with interesting people who are doing cool stuff. You can find past episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Please like and subscribe. Mark Evans is my guest. He's a documentary filmmaker, and his new film focuses on the life and the work of claymation pioneer Will Vinton. Vinton and his company brought stop-motion animation to the world with the California Raisins, but he was eventually fired from his own company. Mark Evans is my guest today on Times Like Now. Hello, Mark. Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Trevor.
A little bit about this claymation act, or the art of it. Will Vinton, Portland legend. Your film called Clay Dream is focusing on Will Vinton. Tell me a little bit about, when did this production start? When did you start following Will with a camera?
I mean, this goes way back to 2015 or 16, probably 2016. I was wrapping up my previous film, The Glamour and the Squalor, and kind of just, you know, always looking for new stories, new ideas. And I'd come across an article about Will that kind of outlined his career, and also went into kind of how everything unraveled for his studio. And as I was reading this article, I really felt like it played out like a movie. And I was familiar with Will's name. I was familiar with a lot of his characters and shows that he'd created, you know, in the 80s and 90s that I kind of grew up with. So I was, so there was the nostalgia factor, but really the story was what intrigued me, and how this kind of rise and fall and all these twists and turns that, like I said, when I was reading the article, it felt like a movie. And so I think it was that day I got really excited about it, and thought this could be an interesting next film. So like I said, I think it was that day I reached out to Will. I found an email address on his website and got an email back pretty quickly, I think, from what said it was his assistant, which I found out later was his wife, and just asked, like, hey, can we get together and talk about this? And the response was like, sure, we can get together, but I'm probably not really interested in making a documentary or anything like that. But I thought that was maybe, you know, that was an in. So we, a couple weeks later, we got together, got some coffee in Portland, and it was, you know, like a 3-hour meeting. And I thought we totally hit it off. And I thought, oh, no, this is great. I think he's going to want to do this. And when I followed up a few days later, he was like, yeah, it was nice to meet, but I still don't think I really want to do it. So that was kind of how it started, but we just stayed in touch over probably about a 6-month period. And over time, I think it was just a lot of, you know, kind of trust building and things like that. And he decided finally, let's go for it. And then from that point on, he was just totally open. Anytime I wanted to shoot something, whether it be an interview or, you know, B-roll or something like that, or if, you know, access to his archives, which was pretty huge. I mean, a lot of, he had a big collection of things that he saved. You know, he wasn't certainly the only resource, but there was a lot of stuff that came from Will. He just had both a basement and a garage full of stuff that anytime I wanted to go over and look through, he was game. So he was a great, not only subject, but, you know, partner in a lot of things. You know, he didn't have any, input necessarily into the, you know, the editing or the way that I was going to tell the story, but, the collaboration as far as like just the materials, he was a total open book.
Yeah. It really feels that way in the movie as well. An interesting character, such an interesting man and artist, and, such a history with going back to the beginnings of claymation. I mean, he coined the word as a mix between clay and animation. Of course, anybody that listening that doesn't know Will Vinton, remember the California Raisins or the Noid or so many other, the M&Ms, that's him as well.
Yeah, and you know, what's funny about those is that all three of those examples, which are huge, you know, in pop culture, they're all commercials. You know, that was certainly, and one of the themes that we kind of go through in the film is like art versus commerce, and it ends up playing out, you know, towards the end of the film in a very big way. But you know, it's interesting that three of his biggest creations are for commercials, but then he also had these art films, these short films that he won an Oscar for, was nominated for many other ones, that were just pure creativity, and really showing, you know, just very high-end art. But yeah, I do find it kind of, you know, I guess ironic that probably three of the characters, that, you know, the M&Ms, the Noid, and the California Raisins that he's known for most are commercials. They were for brands.
Yeah, that's the big audience, and that's the bigger paycheck than a passion project like Closed Monday, which is the one that he won, well, him and his partner won mm-hmm. the Oscar for. And that's a whole nother story between him and his original partner. But I thought about that, what you just mentioned, that if he had somehow released Mark Twain after the success of those other three, it would have been a different audience, a more educated audience, because Mark Twain is such an amazing piece of work. It's so good and famous now, but at the time it was not received well.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, I don't even know if it's famous now. I think there's people of a certain age probably might remember it when they were kids, but they weren't the audience for it. And that was the whole thing, is that it was marketed towards kids, and it was really more of a sophisticated film for adults. But this was in the mid '80s when animated film wasn't really targeted towards adults. It was a kids genre, and that's certainly changed a lot. But it's, it's as Will puts it, it's the zenith of claymation. Ever all the techniques, they're all put into this one film, and kids that did see it remember it today, because there's this one scene called The Mysterious Stranger that I came to find out really terrified a lot of kids, because again, it wasn't really meant for them. So to the extent that it's known today, it's mostly known for that film. But it would be great if that film kind of got a second wind and got to be seen by a new audience in the 2020s.
It would be fantastic, and it has a sort of cult following amongst animation artists, and animation has increased in popularity so much over the years. I think it has grown an audience a little bit, not what it could be, I suppose, but it did set the standard for a lot of that kind of work. I got to visit Will Vinton Studios in the mid '90s, maybe just before the crash, and got to see the figurine of the Mark Twain and some of the others that were in the lobby of the original Will Vinton Studios. I met Will a few times, and just a joy to be around. He really was, and great time. The movie Clay Dreams, you've been playing festivals. Where has it been recently?
I mean, yeah, it just started. It had, we're recording this on June 25th. It had its world premiere as part of the Tribeca Festival on June 13th. And then I just got back from Annecy, France, where we had the international premiere on June 18th, I believe it was. So, it's a week ago. So it's really just been premiered. And then we've got some festivals coming up. I think the only one that's been announced that I can talk about is the Melbourne, Australia Documentary Festival, which is a great festival in Australia. That'll be the Australia premiere, which is in July. But it's kind of an interesting thing, because there people have been talking about it, and there's been press, but as of right now, this moment, it can't be seen anywhere, because it can be seen like during those festivals. And the Tribeca Festival, for instance, was, anybody in the US could have accessed up to a certain point, accessed the film during that festival. But now that festival's over, that's done. So we're hoping to have a wider distribution here shortly, and there's been some conversations going on about that. So hopefully, sometime this year it'll be released for the public to see. But there will be some other festivals that I think will have some online hybrid opportunities, so people could probably stream it that way too in the coming months.
That's good to know. Where would somebody find your website or your information?
Me personally, so I've got a little family business with my wife Angela and our 10-year-old son Jude. We've kind of just got this little creative studio. It's called the Macaw. So the macaw.studio, so THE for the, and then MCCAW.studio is our company website. And it's just, like I said, we're kind of like this little boutique creative company. So we have documentary production, We released two books last year during the pandemic, which we had never done before. But one of them is a children's book. It's an ABC book that my son had come up with the idea when he was like 3 or 4, about his favorite bands and where they were from. That was like the book that he wanted to read at that time. So it took a while, but we created that and put it out last year. A little cocktail book that we put out as well too. But that's kind of where, you know, we combined as a family our creative endeavors under this one umbrella. So it's themacaw.studio.
Super cool. That's great. I'd like to see that book. Back on the movie, did you write, produce, and direct this? Was this all your project, or were you working with others on this?
Yeah, I mean, certainly not all my project, but yeah, I you know, came up with it. You know, so was the producer at the beginning, and you know, obviously when you're, you know, an indie documentary, you're wearing a lot of hats, but you know, came up with it and then got everything going with Will. I brought on a producer, Kevin Moyer, who's from Portland, who was my music supervisor on The Glamour and the Squalor. And then so started kind of with us too. And then we brought on our cinematographer, Jason Rourke, really early. And it was for a long time, for a couple of years, it was just the three of us essentially, you know, going and doing the interviews, you know, all over the country with other subjects and with Will himself, and collecting archives. And then I think it was about 2 years into the project, I got approached by a production company called XYZ Films out of LA. And they're a great and well-known production company, mostly for narrative films, but they had just started a documentary program at that time. And they were just releasing their first feature documentary called Framing John DeLorean, which is a great film about, you know, John DeLorean, the car maker. And it's kind of a hybrid documentary where there's scripted scenes and Alec Baldwin plays DeLorean. So they were finishing that film, looking for other projects, and they had actually, the producer Tamir Ardone had come across the same article I had a couple years earlier and thought, what, the same thing I did, that this would make a great film. And as he started researching it, he realized that this was already being done by me. And so he reached out and we got together and kind of hit it off and joined forces, and they were tremendous partners. And from there, you know, I was editing for a long time, but we ultimately ended up bringing on editor Lucas Seller, who helped finish the film and really bring it to the next level. Our composer, Heather McIntosh. So there's a, you know, certainly, and then other, you know, producers that came on that really helped get the film finished as well too. But so yeah, I mean, if you look at the end credits, you know, it takes a lot of people to finish a feature film.
Yes, of course. The access to the archives was really impressive. We got to see pieces of animation that I don't know if I'd ever seen before on some of these older, some of his first works in 16 millimeter in his days in Berkeley. That must have been very engaging for you to just be able to swim through Will Vinton's, you know, treasure chest of stuff. And how you cut this material into your film is really a great, it almost puts Will as his characters. It really shines in that way that he was putting himself into his work, and you really kind of use your editing techniques to show that. Really impressive what you did here and what you put together. How long did it take you?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I mean, overall, it was about a 5-year process. And, you know, a lot of that is just like chasing interviews and chasing the materials and things like that. And then I was editing along the way. And so, but it was, you know, probably about a year ago is when we got in touch with Lucas Seller, the editor. And we took kind of, you know, the story that I'd been making and just really, you know, bumped it up. And Lucas was able to do a lot of things that I was probably way too close to as the director and producer. And again, at the time, the editor, that I knew there were certain things that I wasn't really getting right, but I just didn't know how to do it. And so we got together and was like, I'd love to do that. I'd love to bring more of Will's personality, more of his character, more of his strengths and flaws out. And there were just all these things that Lucas was able to really bring out. But I appreciate saying that about the, you know, the use, how we use the clips. Like, that was very important to not just show the work, but to have the work mean something. And there was two major things. You know, one, there's the idea of Will as a person. He, throughout really his whole life, he didn't really let people in. A lot of people struggled, like, who is Will Vinton? And I think we got to crack that a little bit in the film, but also a reality is that the way that he, and you'll hear this about a lot of artists, but certainly the way that he expressed himself was through his work and through his characters. So we wanted to make sure that the pieces that we used of his work would do one of two things: either really help us get to know Will, because that is how he was letting people know him, was through his character. So we wanted the pieces that we chose, you know, we could have just shown, you know, random clips, but we wanted them to really represent him, or just represent the story, you know, as the story goes on, and everything with his company is happening. We wanted to choose clips that we felt represented that moment. So that was a lot of fun. That was probably one of my most favorite parts of the editing process. But as you said earlier, we also had so much material. So it didn't make it easy. I mean, in some cases it makes it harder. We've got so many choices to make, but it certainly made it a lot of fun to be able to go through, you know, all the way from his early work when he was at Berkeley in college and just creating stuff with friends that, you know, that we were fortunate that he saved, towards the end of the process, we were able to, a lot of the short films that he did, we had in the quality that Will gave us, which was fine. It was usable. We were going to use it in the film, but the Academy had preserved his film. So he had sent, at some point, he had sent the film reels, the final films, to the Academy, and they had digitized them in 2K and 4K. So by the end of it, we were able to show all of those films in our film. That, you know, we did the film in 4K, but a lot of that stuff that we originally had was not that quality, but we were able to get it all up-resed into 4K. So it was pretty amazing to see it in the highest quality as well.
Yeah, that makes for a better viewing. But amazing editing and filming with the material that was done when his what did you call that? You wouldn't call it a court case, when they're sitting around the big table, Phil Knight and Travis Knight and Will and the lawyers. That material
deposition.
The depositions, yes, there were three cameras at least in that room documenting that episode.
Yeah, and I had nothing to do with that. That
right.
Happened in the, you know, early 2000s. I might have been shot in like 2003, 2004. And that was, you know, God, that when we got that footage, that was kind of a game changer, because I always knew that that was going to be part of the story, but I didn't know that we were going to have that material that actually was in the room. And like you said, I think they, you know, three cameras, and Will had that shot. Will, I don't think he ever had any idea why he was going to shoot it, but he had the intuition to shoot these depositions and shoot it well, you know? So he hired a team, but I didn't know about it though. I didn't know about that footage, that it existed, until 2 years into the project. And Will just casually, I was, you know, at his place looking through materials, and he just casually mentioned, he goes, "Did I ever give you the deposition?" And I was like, "What do you mean? Like, are there, like, there's transcripts of it or something?" And he's like, "No, we shot it." And so I was like, "No, you never did." And so we found the boxes. They were these old beta tapes. They had never been digitized or anything. They had just been sitting in his basement collecting dust for, you know, 15 years. And so I got back home. I was living in San Diego at the time, got back home and found a place that could transfer them. And I still remember, you know, when I started going through it and realized what we had there, that's when, you know, the project really kind of took on a different life at that point, because I knew that would be a framing device that we could basically introduce at the beginning of the film and keep coming back to. It was amazing to have that material.
Yeah, that really is, you know, ultimately the crux of the story is when it all starts to go bad and how his dream begins to unravel. And that's where it was happening, literally in that room at that moment. The Phil Knight, I remember when this happened, and many, many people would say it was a takeover, but it was pretty sneaky, the kind of contractual things that Phil Knight and Travis Knight did to Will Vinton to literally take his company from him. Do you want to explain a little bit about that from your side and what you know of it?
Yeah, I mean, and I tried to be in the film, you know, not like choosing sides, but just try to kind of show how it played out, because It's definitely an interesting thing. Like, again, like I said, that one of the themes is art versus commerce, and it plays out with Will's own stuff. You know, he had the commercial stuff, and he had the kind of, you know, art films that he made, and he made his name kind of on the commercial stuff. But also, it plays out with, you know, if you want to say, for lack of better terms, Will Vinton versus Phil Knight, this art versus commerce battle that they had. But it is interesting because I think, you know, if you watch the movie, I don't want to give too much away because I do like people to kind of put their own judgment on how things happened. You know, you might talk to more artistic, creative people, and they are going to look at it and say, oh, I can't believe what happened to Will Vinton. I can't believe that Phil Knight treated him this way. And they're just up in arms. But then you might talk to some business people that look at it and say, well, that's just business, you know, and Will made mistakes and Phil did what he had to do. So I think it's really an interesting, and I, you know, there could have been opportunities to try to tell the story, you know, more one-sided, but I did want it to just play out as kind of truthful as possible. And I was very curious to see how people would put their own judgments on how it played out, and it's been interesting seeing, you know, the response, you know, from the two festivals that we premiered the film at, how people are talking about that.
Well, please share. I am kind of curious how the audience have been responding to your new film.
Yeah, I mean, the response has been great, and as far as that goes, it's just been kind of across the board, the response. I mean, again, it just depends on the type of person. You know, there's certain publications, there's people that are, you know, very creative. I was looking at this article by Cartoon Brew, which is a great animated animation website, and their review was very critical and talked about this, like, you know, this vicious battle between Phil Knight and Will Vinton, and, you know, the company when you know, again, I don't want to give too much away, but you know, there's a big storyline for the animation industry, and this particular writer was very critical, and it left a bad taste, really bad taste in his mouth, but what the Knights did. But then there's other people that might look at it and say, you know, no, that's just business.
Yeah, I guess that's where you stand on it, what people see. Your past film, the documentary about Marco Collins, the radio DJ from Seattle. He was kind of the voice of the Seattle sound. Your documentary, this is how I first saw your work. It was at a Portland Film Festival. That film, Glamour and the Squalor. When did that come about? Was that your first documentary, or do you have other work that I may not have seen?
Yeah, that was my first feature. And, you know, there was a film before that was kind of like, you know, for me, like, I call it like my film school, essentially, that but that film is still actually in progress. It's been like this 11-year journey that I started with my brother in Haiti. So but The Glamour and the Squalor was, yeah, that was the first feature film that I'd released, that I'd, you know, directed.
Making documentaries is very different from making narrative feature films. What's your takeaway, or what have you learned or gleaned from following these two interesting characters in your first two documentaries?
You know, sometimes I kind of wonder, like, man, I can't believe that people let a documentary, allow a documentary to be made about them, because we, as, you know, the filmmakers, it's so intrusive. We come into their lives, and that's where I think just honesty and trying to be as transparent as possible up front is so important, and making sure subjects know, like, you know, yes, we're going to go over all the positives, but you can't just have this, like, total puff piece, because then nobody's going to take it seriously. You know, movies have to have conflict. They've got to have drama. So that's super important. But then even then, you don't know how things are going to shake out, because you don't know how production's going to go. You don't know if anything's going to happen while, you know, in the storyline while you're making it. You don't know if you're interviewing people, what you're going to uncover. So you try to be as honest as possible upfront about, to set the expectations. But even then, you never know exactly what's going to happen. And, you know, I'm probably personally kind of a private person. So I just think about it sometimes, like, I can't imagine having my whole life, you know, everything, my strengths and flaws, all being out there for the world to see. But I'm so grateful that people do open themselves up for that, because, you know, think about, you know, documentary, for instance, just about how many great stories and great people we've learned about from that. So, but I think, you know, I don't necessarily think like, oh, my films, you know, I want to do like biographical films, but it, you know, I loved Marco's story when I first heard it, which was also, I found, you know, there was an article that came out that I read that I thought was really interesting and that his story would be good as a documentary. And then same thing with Will. And I think I do like biographical, even, you know, I like reading biographical books, for instance. But like I said, sometimes I'm just, it astonishes me that, we're allowed into people's lives that they let us do that.
Yeah. I mean, when somebody's living a life like that, you know, like you said, some of the scars you may not want to be shown, but it really makes for a better film, obviously. That movie, Glamour and the Squalor, and Marco, did that go on to other festivals? I mean, I saw it in Portland. Did you go like internationally with that film?
Yeah, I mean, it played at festivals kind of all over the world, and then it got picked up for domestic distribution, and then also we sold it to Red Bull Media House, which, you know, which is Red Bull's media division, and we gave them kind of worldwide rights for it. And I haven't necessarily seen exactly what they've done with it, but they had the rights to all the other territories, and you know, it's on their platform and everything. But that can be seen on, I think, Amazon Prime is probably the best place to watch that movie. But it's also on Tubi and Vudu now as well too, which I think are free platforms, which that's kind of a new distribution deal that just came out. So that's definitely available. But yeah, it was fun. I mean, that played at a lot of festivals, you know, certainly around the country, but even international as well. And that's definitely one of the more, you know, fun parts is being able to travel with the film and see it with new audiences. And so that's been that's been different for Clay Dream because, you know, the Tribeca Festival, that was a virtual premiere. So, you know, it was all people all over the country could have access to. You didn't have to be in New York, but it also wasn't this big event, this big screening. Which, you know, it's always fun to see the work with an audience. And I think we'll have that opportunity now as things continue to slowly open up. I think probably this fall, there's going to be some opportunities for some in-person screenings. So that'll be a lot of fun to see it with an audience.
Well, yeah, if you get up here into the northwest corner of the United States, I'd love to see the film somewhere locally around here. What's next? Do you have anything that you're researching, that you're working on, that you might let me know about? Or are you still just focused on Clay Dream and showing it?
Yeah, there's two. Well, one, I want to finish this film in Haiti with my brother. And then there's two projects that I've been developing for a while. There's a kind of a true crime murder mystery documentary based in Alaska that I've been working on for a couple of years that we're trying to get made. That it's you know, we're pitching it as kind of like a Twin Peaks meets Fargo type show, but it's, you know, it's a true story to be documentary. So definitely excited about that one. And then there's a documentary show kind of that it centers around the Stoic philosophy, Stoicism, you know, which was founded 2000 years ago, but there's a very modern angle to this in a lot of ways. People that are practicing it and applying it to their lives today. Very well-known celebrities that are practicing Stoicism. So those are the two projects that I'm spending most time on developing and pitching. And one of those two, or hopefully both of those two, will be most likely the next projects to go.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Well, to both of those, but that Stoicism, I read about that philosophy myself. Mark, thank you so much. Again, where would people find your material? What is that website?
Yeah, I think the best place would just be www.themacaw.studio, which is my little family creative company.
Keep an eye out for Mark Evans' new documentary, Clay Dream, about Will Vinton. Thank you once again, and have a good evening.
Thanks, Trevor. Good talking to you.
Past episodes of Times Like Now can be found wherever you get your podcasts. Please do like and subscribe. My name is Trevor Collins. I can be reached, trevor@timeslikenow.com. And thank you to the letter J, Cody Robertson, for original music. I look forward to speaking with you all next time.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Kenny Halfand. He is the Philip H. Knight Professor of Landscape Architecture Emeritus at the University of Oregon and author of the book Lawrence Halprin. He's here to talk about Lawrence Halprin Fountains, which is a show on from June 23rd to mid-September at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education. Thank you so much for doing Art Focus in person, Kenny.
Thank you, Joseph. We're standing now actually at the Source Fountain, which is the beginning of the sequence of the Portland Open Face System designed by Lawrence Halprin beginning in the 1960s and taking about the next 10 years to complete. The fountain is a piece of, all these fountains are a piece of an open space system, part of an urban renewal district in South Portland. South Portland was largely an immigrant neighborhood that was essentially demolished during the urban renewal era. It was seen by outsiders as a slum, although it was a thriving, largely immigrant community. The design of the area was by Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, the architects, and then Lawrence Halprin, noted landscape architect from San Francisco, was called in to design the open space sequence. Some of you may know other works by Halprin, perhaps most notably the FDR Memorial, Giardelli Square, the Sea Ranch development on the California coast. He's one of America's great landscape architects. We're standing here looking at the Sorth Fountain, which is not very large. It's not even 5 feet tall. It's just a series of essentially a brick pyramid, which may remind people of pyramids, remind some people of kind of Mesoamerican architecture. It was also intended to be a spring, a place of origin. And if you stand here, kind of you look down, a kind of long sequence, an alley of trees, also part of the sequence that Halprin designed, all the paving, all the planting, all the trees that you see, that leads you essentially down a long sloping hill towards the next site, which will be kind of Lovejoy Plaza that he designed, the first of his great fountains.
I would say if you're going to come and check them all out, one, they're kind of tucked away. As you come out of the Keller Auditorium, the main glass doors, and turn left, if you wanted to, you could go up the step, go down this area, this road, which is, I guess,